She disquieted her. Intuitively, she had known something about Kip was wonderfully strange, but the hard life that she had led conditioned her to reject any consideration that there might be magic in the world, and instead to resort always to cold reason. On the computer screen, Dorothy introduced the rest of her story with a wide smile and a shake of her head. "And so I told him that the ghost of Christmas yet to come was showing Scrooge not what would be, but only what might be. I put the MP3 player on the floor and told him that Tiny Tim wouldn't die, that I'd play the rest of the book for him only if he stopped this pretense of ordinariness. He ran to the player and stood over it, staring down at it, wagging his tail furiously. I turned it on, and he sat listening to the rest without moving. That night I designed a rather clumsy version of the pedal-operated laser pointer that would eventually be refined, and which Kip would use to spotlight letters of the alphabet to communicate with me. I must tell you, Rosa, I felt like a bespelled child in a fairy tale, or some little girl in a Spielberg movie, and at the same time I wondered if I might be going mad, a doddering old woman who could no longer trust her senses. But if I doddered into anything, I doddered into the fantastic truth of what Kip is." Chapter 23 The carved grizzly was stupid. Maybe brown bears and black bears roamed the California mountains, but not grizzlies. What was the point of having it here anyway? To terrify the campers and drive their business away? Although dogs had lived with people for thousands of years, a lot of things people did mystified Kip. Giant wood grizzly bears, no more or less than abstract impressionist art and nose rings. Worse than a grizzly bear, Fred, the brother of Frank the Hater and probably a hater as well, was en route. Even a dog of greatly enhanced intelligence might find it difficult to escape from a puppy mill cage and change servitude. The leash tethering Kip to the carving of a bear was 8 or 10 feet long. He managed to turn and get a mouthful of it. Although the fabric proved to be tough, his teeth were up to the task. He chewed and tugged vigorously. From his office chair, Frank the Hater said, "What the hell are you doing?" Even if Kip had been able to talk, he wouldn't have stopped chewing to explain his intention to escape. If the question wasn't rhetorical, Frank was even dumber than he looked. "I know your kind, dog. I know how to deal with you." Green eyes flashing under his mustache-sized eyebrows, the Hater came around the desk. Kip growled, but continued chewing on the leash. When the Hater tried to grab the back of the dog collar, Kip sidled around to face him, growling more ferociously as he chewed. "Better shut you in the bathroom till Fred gets here." Frank the Hater reached up to untie his captive from one of the steel rods between the bear and the wall. Kip dropped the leash and snapped at his captor. He didn't intend to bite, just to scare the men off. Suddenly reeking of anger as much as he did of hatred, Frank backed away a few steps. He took off his belt and clenched the tongue of it in his right fist. The buckle dangled at the free end.
"Teach you a lesson," said Frank, the angry Hater.
When he lashed with the belt, the buckle missed Kip and cracked against the wooden bear.
"Down!"
the man ordered. Kip did not lie down. He growled and bared his teeth.
"Down! Down, damn you!"
the Hater commanded. He raised his right hand high, intending to whip harder this time, more accurately, maybe repeatedly. Just then the front door opened and a stranger came in. He said,
"Hey, hey, hey, what are you doing?"
"Stay back," Frank the Hater warned. "I've got a vicious damn dog here. He's a half-wild stray."
Wagging his tail, Kip whined as pathetically as he knew how, and cowered before the Hater's raised fist.
"Never hit a dog," said the newcomer.
The stint of Frank's anger grew more intense. He was enraged now with both Kip and the stranger.
"Get your ass out of here before you're bitten," said the Hater, "and leave this to me."
"I'll leave when I've got my dog,"
the man declared, stepping between Kip and the Hater.
"Your dog? He's a damn stray. No license tag on his collar."
Untying the lead from the steel rod, the newcomer said,
"He's my dog."
"Like hell he is."
"If you strike him again, so help me God, I'll cinch that belt around your neck tight enough to make your face turn blue.
In addition to the garlic, verbena aftershave, coconut-scented hand sanitizer, antiperspirant, chapstick, pee on his shoes, anger, and hatred, Frank also smelled of the particular kind of fear that had a sour edge, and was called cowardice.
"This here's a dog-free campground," he blustered. "Always has been dog-free, and I mean to keep it dog-free. You can't have a dog on my watch."
Reading the name on the khaki shirt, the stranger said, "I won't be checking in, Frank. Cancel the reservations for Hawkins."
"If you haven't checked in yet, he can't be your dog."
Ignoring the hater, the newcomer smiled down at Kip.
"Come on, boy. Let's blow this dump."
As Kip's rescuer opened the front door, Frank the hater made one last attempt to assert his authority.
"He can't be your dog."
"Put your belt on before your pants fall down, Frank. I haven't had dinner yet, so don't ruin my appetite."
Chapter 24 Rosa sat for a few minutes in the grip of the strangest web of emotions that she had ever known. Spending this time with Dorothy's recordings had sharpened her grief. Yet the videos of Dorothy and Kip communicating with the aid of the alphabet wall and the laser pointer had been captivating, exhilarating. Sadness contested with elation in a way that she had never before experienced. Amazement, which was of the intellect, and astonishment, which was of the heart, matured into awe that weighed so heavily on her that she could not get up from the chair. And then she did. She went to the alphabet wall and stood staring at it for a minute or two before kneeling at the motorized laser pointer. The device, based on Dorothy's design, had been built for her by a local mechanic named John Cobb. Mr. Cobb had wondered for what reason she required such a thing. She had told him that it had applications in a classroom, and that she would say no more because, after a period of testing, she intended to obtain a patent on it. This lie satisfied Cobb, as perhaps he would not have been satisfied if she had told him that she needed it to better communicate with her dog. A flip switch on the center column turned on the laser pointer and the motor that operated it. Mounted on a gimbal, the pointer swiveled at once to fix its red dot on the letter A. 4 canted pedals control the device. From left to right, the first pedal moved the red dot up, the second moved it down, the third to the left, the fourth to the right. They were meant to be pressed by a paw, but Rose's hand served just as well. Remembering as best she could what she had seen in one of the videos to get a sense of how laborious had been this method of communication, Rosa worked the answer to a question that Dorothy had asked Kip. "You say you can communicate with others of your kind at any distance. But how?" One by one, with the use of the pedals, the pointer now picked up the letters as Kip had done, which Dorothy had written down as she watched from her desk, and which Rosa had copied.
"Telepathy. Birds have a form of it, which is why every member of a flock can change direction in flight at the same instant. Elephants have it, the way they come from a distance to the side of one who is dying. But the Mysterium's telepathy is much stronger. We call it the wire."
Either the first of their kind learned English in some genetics lab where they'd been engineered, or after escaping maybe they picked it up by listening to the people who cared for them. The how of this was lost in the mists of their creation. Currently, however, the young dogs received the English language and packets of other knowledge from their elders over the wire, in mere minutes, in what amounted to the installation of a program. Many high-tech mavens, like the flamboyant Elon Musk and the lesser-known Ray Kurzweil, dreamed of the singularity, the moment when human and machine intelligence would merge, ushering in the post-human era. They claimed that augmented human brains, injected with a neural lace, would connect with one another by telepathy and almost instantaneously share vast architectures of knowledge and theory that once would have taken years for one person to teach another. The Mysterium had achieved at least that one goal of the cult of the singularity without the need to become partly machines. They didn't know how this might have happened, whether their creators intended it, or if the telepathy was an unanticipated consequence of the genetic engineering that had enhanced their intelligence. What was, simply was. They saw no need to brood excessively about it. Rosa switched off the motorized laser pointer
and got to her feet and stood for a moment, trembling at the prospect of seeking out Kip, wherever he might be huddled in grief, and trying to begin a life together. He had loved Dorothy with such devotion. No one had ever loved Rosa with such fervor. She doubted that anyone could. She was not as special as Dorothy, and could only be a disappointment to Kip. She went to the windows that provided a view of the forest in which the overcast had laid down an early twilight. A mist rose off the lake, creeping uphill through the trees, its millions of tiny droplets reflecting what little light the day offered, fluorescing as if it were not a cloud, but the ghost light of spirit legions haunting the day's end. Perhaps because Rosa Leon had been abandoned by a father who called her the mistake of a mistake, and because her mother had not loved her, and because she had grown up without the experience of affection that would have taught her how to make friends more easily, she acutely felt not merely the wonder of sweet Kip and the Mysterium, but also the essential loneliness with which they surely contended, even though telepathy was a powerful bond. After all, they numbered only 86, such a small community that existential angst must on some level trouble them. For lack of numbers, their kind could go extinct. New members of the Mysterium appeared on the wire so seldom, the assumption had to be that the gene sequence that made them unique among all other dogs was not easily passed down from generation to generation. As far as Dorothy and Kip had been able to determine, he alone of his litter was a Mysterian. Although one like Kip could show up in the litter produced by two ordinary dogs, that was rare, the expression of Mysterian genes that were recessive either in the male or female. As a consequence, Mysterium protocols that regarded mating had for some time required them to choose a mate only from among their own kind. But as the number of males and females was not always in perfect balance, at times some of them had no immediate hope of a mate. At the moment, there were more males than females. Two other constraints hampered the growth of their community. First, monogamy. In nature, there were many species that mated for life. This was not ordinarily true of dogs, but the Mysterians had decided that it was true for them, and they were faithful to their mates as perhaps most of humanity was not. Also, for whatever reason, they didn't produce large litters, as did ordinary dogs. There was a tendency for some females to be barren, and some males to be sterile, and even when litters formed, they were no larger than three. Often there was no litter at all, just one pup. With no prospect of a mate and having lost his beloved human companion, Kip had only the community of the wire. Although that was precious, it was not enough for a creature as sociable as he'd always been. In Rosa's estimation, he deserved better than her. She sighed and said, "But I'm what you have, dear Kip." As the ascending mist pressed through the pines and reached the yard beyond the flagstone terrace, Rosa turned from the window and went in search of the grieving dog who was more than a dog, who was, in fact, hers to cherish and protect, like the child she never had. She started in the kitchen, because that and the library were Kip's favorite rooms. Earlier, before she'd gone to the mortuary to make arrangements and attend the cremation, she had put out a bowl of food for Kip and another of fresh water. Both were untouched. In his grief, he might have had no appetite, though Goldens were chowhounds. Nevertheless, he would have needed water. Disquieted but not yet alarmed, Rosa went room to room through the ground floor, calling his name. Her voice echoed off the walls with an eerie hollowness, as if all the furniture had been removed, and the windows boarded up, and the house abandoned to the merciless progress of time and decay. As she climbed the stairs and reached the upper floor, Rosa was shouting urgently, "Kip! Where are you, Kip?" Disquiet swelled into a terrible apprehension, a piercing fear that she'd already failed at fulfilling this greatest responsibility of her life. Chamber by chamber, through closets, along corridors, peering under this and behind that, upstairs twice from end to end, downstairs again, front to back, she searched, but wasn't rewarded by the sight, the sound, or any trace of him. Kip was gone. Chapter 25. In the front passenger seat of the Range Rover, safety harness snugged around him, Kip liked what he smelled of his rescuer.
kindness, confidence, a hint of soap, the fresh minty scent of chewing gum, the fragrant juice of trodden wild grass on his shoe soles, and very little earwax, among other things. No aftershave, no coconut-scented hand sanitizer, no misfired urine anywhere on him. As they pulled out of the campground toward the state route, the man said, "Thanks to my mom and dad, my name's Brennadon. If they know what's good for them, people call me Ben." In the campground office, he had told Frank the Hater to cancel the reservation for Hawkins. So he was Ben Hawkins. "What do people call you?" Ben asked. Kip grinned at him. "You're the strong, silent type, huh?" They turned northwest. That was good. The murmuring thoughts of the young boy on the wire were coming from that direction. "I'll think of a name for you. I'm good at names." Kip leaned forward in his harness to sniff the glove box. It contained some kind of cheese crackers. "Well, we won't rush the name thing. Names are important. In my line of work, I have to come up with a lot of memorable names." Kip could smell peanut butter between the cheese crackers and the glove box. "I write novels," Ben said. "What line of work are you in?" To convey certain emotions to Dorothy, Kip had developed a few special noises. As an expression of amusement, he made a soft, rapid, panting sound. "I used to be a Navy SEAL. When I signed up for that, I didn't realize how many people would be shooting at me. So after like 8 years, when I was still alive, I decided to change careers." Kip looked away from the glove box, cocked his head, regarded his rescuer with interest. "Now some book critics snipe at me, but they don't kill anyone. Though there's one I suspect has bodies buried in his basement." Nature was full of patterns, and life was full of coincidences, and Kip believed that something like destiny was always at work. Dorothy loved books. Kip got his love of stories from her. Now here was a writer of stories, who was also a warrior. If destiny was real, the warrior part of Ben Hawkins was probably as important as the writer part, which meant maybe serious trouble was coming. "It's getting late to set up camp." On both sides of the highway, the woods filled with gloom. Ben said, "We'll find a motel. They might not take dogs, so you'll have to use your invisibility cloak." Kip issued a heh-heh-heh-heh-heh and squirmed partly free of the harness so that he could lie on the seat below window level. After driving the better part of a minute in silence and glancing repeatedly at his passenger, Ben said, "There's something strange about you, Rin-Tin-Tin." Kip grumbled rather than growled. "You don't like that name?" Again, Kip grumbled. "Okay, all right, we'll find a better one, Scooby-Doo." Chapter 26. A meatloaf was finishing in one oven, and a potato and cheese casserole appeared nearly ready to come out of the other oven, and on the breakfast table, a platter of muffins glistened under lemon icing. In the refrigerator were a bowl of egg salad, chicken breasts in a marinade, cleaned cauliflower, peeled and sliced carrots. Verna Brickett, the 3 times a week housekeeper, who would be perfect casting if Hollywood ever remade the old Ma and Pa Kettle movies, washed dishes, while Megan dried them and put them away. The 2 dishwashers were of the generation produced after the latest round of government regulations related to water and energy usage, and very little came out of them clean. The main purpose they served was to fill in what otherwise would have been 2 gaping holes in the cabinetry. Verna said, "What makes people who've never designed a useful piece of machinery in their lives think they know how a dishwasher ought to work?" "Hubris," said Megan. "A pox on all their houses," Verna declared. "And don't get me started on toilets. Will there ever be a toilet again that gives you enough water so you only have to flush once? Or am I just doomed to carpal tunnel syndrome of the right hand?"
"TMI, Verna."
Verna refused to vote for any of the current political parties on the ballot. She was waiting for a new party to be formed that she called the Common Damn Sense Party. "Would you go to Mars with a group of damn fools that think they can colonize it tomorrow?" Verna asked. Drying a colander, Megan said, "I wouldn't go to Mars even with the greatest group of geniuses who ever lived. I like having air to breathe."
"I saw on TV this Chinese billionaire who wants to get a colony going on Mars in 7 to 10 years. So if an asteroid hits the Earth or nuclear war wrecks the planet, humankind won't all be destroyed. Hell, there's about enough water on Mars to flush a toilet twice, but he thinks it could be a swell place to live.
Some people, if they get enough billions, Megan said, it seems to give them a little too much self-confidence.
I'll guard against that when I make my first billion.
Verna set the last dish, a mixing bowl, in the drying rack.
The meatloaf and potatoes should be ready in a few minutes. I'll put them out to cool and then be off.
Give my best to Sam.
He threatened to fix the lawnmower himself this afternoon. I want to get home while he still has both hands.
Zverna snatched up a large plastic bag by its knotted neck to take it outside to the trash can. Megan hung the damp dish towel on its rack. See you Friday.
Tell Woody I made the muffins specially for him. Have a couple yourself, skinny as you are.
I bet they don't have good muffins on Mars. As she opened the back door, Verna said,
They don't have shit on Mars.
She paused before stepping outside, turned to Megan, and said,
I haven't breathed a word to you about the painting you've been working on, Woody and the deer, but now it's almost done.
She hesitated.
I'm no fancy art critic, so maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
Most fancy art critics don't know what they're talking about either. You've got the eyes. So tell me. I won't be offended.
Well, I've got to say it's a damn good thing you came back to Pinehaven. You healed your heart here and came into the fullness of your soul. You couldn't have painted anything that good if you were somewhere else.
Thank you, Verna. That's very sweet.
I wish your mother had lived to know Woody and to see that painting. How it brings a chill along your spine. A good chill.
Sarah Grassley had died of leukemia when Megan was 15. Her father remarried 5 years later, and now lived in Florida with his new family. She wasn't estranged to him, wished they were closer, but he was a man with a limited supply of affection. He seemed able to deal with her only as if he were an uncle rather than a father. Verna took the trash outside, leaving the door open behind her. Not having connected with Woody in a while, Megan went upstairs to make sure that everything was all right with him. Chapter 27. After the action in the wild grass with Justine, Lee Shackett finds himself following the wet scent and the slithery susurration of a stream that flows through the meadow. He kneels on its bank. He is satiated. His limbs are heavy, and his thoughts are slow, and he has never felt more complete. In the fading light, the sliding water doesn't make a good mirror. His reflection is faint and distorted, and his eye sockets appear to be empty. With one hand, he smooths the water, as though he can still its rippled surface and see himself more clearly. But this doesn't work. He washes the blood out of his hair, from his face. He cups his hands and scoops from the stream and drinks. At first the water has the flavor of blood, but then it acquires a lesser taste. He strips off his black leather sport coat. After shrugging out of the shoulder rig, he puts it aside with the pistol. He discards his spattered shirt. He's gotten blood on his t-shirt and jeans. Not much. Anyway, the t-shirt and jeans are black, so the stains don't show. Besides, the scent appeals to him. Semi-metallic. Not like any other smell. It's the exciting odor of power, dominance, triumph. In his great triumph, he wants to leave the meadow for the woods and find a safe place and curl up there and sleep. He stands now on the bank of the stream, staring across it and into the trees, into the shadows coiling around the trunks and up into the branches, a serpentorium of shadows. Darkness is gathering within and without him. He senses that it's different from all other darknesses that have come before it. This will be a generous and welcoming darkness, one in which he will at last feel at home and never again be a victim. In time there will be Costa Rica, and all the money to have anything he wants, anything, anybody. But right now he feels the need to give himself to the arms of darkness and sleep. Then he sees the pistol in the holster, lying at his feet, and he's reminded of Megan Bookman, remembers how she treated him back in the day, and earlier this afternoon on the phone. He can't tolerate being disrespected like that. If you allow yourself to be disrespected, you're weak. The weak inevitably become prey. Prey dies. Prey dies by tooth and claw. Leaving the holster behind, pistol in hand, he retrieves his black sport coat and sets out across the meadow. He thinks he's going to his car, the Dodge, but somehow he finds himself standing over the dead woman, Justine.
A sort of manic glee overcomes him at the sight of a ravaged corpse, a sense of immeasurable superiority. A wet, snickering laugh escapes him. Who is she, after all? Just another hot girl. So easy to take, to break. All his life, he had allowed such girls to say no to him. He should never have let them say no to him. No isn't a choice for them any longer. A sudden exhilaration burns away his lethargy. His heavy-lidded eyes open wide to the wonder of what he's becoming. He spits on her remains, and spits again. Without quite realizing what he's about to do, Shacket finds himself urinating on the corpse. His stream is strong and fragrant. This kill belongs to him. No one else can want it, claim it. He makes his way through the tall grass to the corpse of the man whose muscles availed him nothing. Shacket urinates again. He is renewed. He zippers himself away. Like something that might live under bridges in expectation of passing children, he scampers up the long slope to the roadway where the two vehicles wait. In his Dodge Demon, powering forward, he leaves one state highway for another, heading north toward the great attractant, toward the woman who should always have been his. Not much farther. He knows her address. He's seen her home from the air on Google Earth, also on Google Street View. Ever since Jason died, Shacket has been keeping track of Megan, the Ice Queen bitch. He knows what she needs better than she does, and he will wake her to the need to please him. In half an hour, he reaches Pinehaven, passes through town, and continues on the state route until her house appears on the left. He almost swings into the driveway, but realizes that too bold an entry will be a mistake. He continues past the house. In less than a quarter of a mile, he arrives at a lay-by. He pulls off the pavement and parks in the deep shade of ancient pines. When he gets out of the car, he stands by it, inhaling the pleasantly cool air, the fragrance of pines, the forest mast. He can also detect the scents of small animals cowering in the underbrush. He can't differentiate one from the other by species, although maybe one day he will. With the highway to one side of him and the wilderness to the other side, he is a creature of two worlds. Perhaps some men, during a profound becoming such as this, would worry that they might soon belong in neither world. Shacket doesn't doubt that he will belong in both, will dominate both. The billions of programmed archaea that he inhaled in the Utah facility have swarmed through his blood, through his flesh and bone and brain, where they remain at work, inserting new genetic material into every cell in his body. What that material might be, he cannot say. But the particular group of researchers at refined Springville Laboratories had been identifying those useful genes in everything from fungi to insects to lower animals that they believed would enhance the human immune system and increase longevity. They had the best of intentions. And intentions mattered. They're all dead now. Gone to ashes because some damn fool panicked and pressed the doomsday button, convinced that a release of programmed archaea into the environment would precipitate some genetic plague. But archaea are not bacteria. They can't replicate the particular genetic material they brought with them into Shacket. Whatever it might be, that material was a one-time cargo with which the scientists loaded them. If Shacket is infected with biological catastrophe, he can't pass it on to others. Nor can these redesigned archaea, which have been engineered to be short-lived and incapable of reproduction. Anyway, there is no biological catastrophe. He is stronger than he's ever been. His hearing and sense of smell are growing more sensitive by the hour. His sight, in particular, is improving. When he turns to stare into the forest, the details of that woodscape resolve out of the steadily deepening shadows as they might for a cat. Felines have a degree of night vision thanks to the many layered mirrors behind their retina. And what secrets of the night can be seen by the multifaceted, metallic-sheen eyes of certain moths that thrive in darkness? Instead of a biological catastrophe, Shacket is a triumph of science, a man becoming more than a man, the only one like him in the world, ascendant. Leaving the coat in the car, holding the pistol at his side, he crosses two lanes of blacktop and enters another arm of the forest.
Guided by inerrant senses he didn't previously possess, he makes his way through the trees and onto a lawn at the side of the Bookman residence. The house stands perhaps 100 feet away. He surveys the windows, some curtained and some not. No faces at any of them, no movement beyond, a stillness upon the house. Shackett crosses the yard and moves along the side of the house. He comes to the back porch just as a woman, not Megan, apparently the housekeeper, comes through the back door, carrying what appears to be a bag of trash. She doesn't look toward him, descends the steps, and bustles around the farther side of the residence. She's older, and of little interest to him, except he will have to kill her if she sees him. He doesn't want to kill her if it can't be done quietly, and it probably can't. He wants Megan to become aware of him only when he slips naked into her bed and wakes her in the night. The moment the housekeeper is out of sight, he swings over the railing onto the porch. He crosses to the door that she left open and steps into the kitchen. The room is bright and clean and warm. The air is redolent of cooking odors. He hears the lid of a trash can clatter into place outside. The older woman will be returning. A swinging door leads into the hallway. He eases it shut behind him, stands listening. All is quiet until the housekeeper returns and begins attending to whatever tasks remain at the end of her day. This house is large, but it's not so grand that live-in help is required. When the housekeeper leaves, there'll be just Megan, the mute boy, and Shackett. Then there will be consequences for the disrespect with which he's been treated. Before he reaches the front of the house and the main stairs, there's a side hall to the left. The walls here are decorated with Megan's paintings, which tend to be large. He has studied her art online. Initially he wanted to like it, but he could never relate to it. Now it seems even more absurd and childish than previously. He can't comprehend her purpose or why anyone would purchase such art other than to burn it. She obviously is not woke to the new world that is coming with unrelenting fury. As technology races onward, and with it enlightened thinking, as hidebound societies reshaped and outdated mores are consigned to the dustbin of history, as thrilling new social norms replace the old, as previous virtues come to be seen as mere weaknesses, and raw power is rightly understood to be the sole remaining virtue, much will need to be burned. Shredded and burned, torn down and hammered into dust. A shining future cannot be built on a past of ignorance and error. To build a brighter tomorrow, it's necessary to descend into a place darker than darkness, to clean the corrupt world with blood and destruction. By the time he reaches the end of the hall, he is convinced that Megan's paintings prove she is not woke to the better world that can be, will be. Shackett will wake her to it. Bella on the Wire. Bella was 6 years old. She was a yellow Labrador retriever. She was always happy. Even on those occasions when she was a little bit sad, she was at the same time happy on top of the sad. The sadness was secondary. As far as she could recall, there had been only one period of unadulterated happiness in her life, and that had been related to an encounter with a skunk. There was more intelligence of different degrees and kinds in nature's creatures than human beings knew, but not in skunks. Skunks were a stupid and dangerous species, specifically because they didn't need to be smart to survive. Whenever she looked at herself in a mirror, Bella was always surprised at how big she was. 70 pounds, and not fat. She'd always thought of herself as small. In a world of humans who stood high on two legs, it proved difficult to maintain a proper sense of her own dimensions. She lived in Santa Rosa, a small city approximately 55 air miles north of San Francisco. Although she'd never flown in an airplane or otherwise, Bella knew air miles, and a lot more. She resided with Andrea and Bill Montell. Bill was an attorney. Andrea owned a bookstore where Bella was welcome. She never annoyed the bookstore customers, and never let on that some of them had literary tastes she found unfortunate. Andrea and Bill had 4 children. Between the ages of 7 and 14. In ascending order, Millie, Dennis, Sam, and Lorinda. All were homeschooled. They were a tightly knit, loving family. They all adored Bella, and she adored them. so it was a typical dog-human family situation. Kids, bookstore, law office. Bella's days were busy, filled with play and affection. Walks with Andrea, runs with Bill, games with the kids, public relations work at the bookstore. Bella was never bored. In addition, she had a secret life. The Montells were aware that their dog was quite smart, but they didn't have a clue as to the extent of her intelligence. They knew nothing of the Mysterium. They didn't know she retrieved books from their library and read them at night. When she was much younger, Bella decided that revealing her true nature would be unfair to the children. To develop a healthy psychology and the right measure of self-esteem, every growing child needed to stand center stage, in the spotlight, from time to time. Once Bella had revealed the truth of herself, the center stage would always be hers, no matter how she insisted on relinquishing it to each child. Anyway, what was to be gained by openly being an intelligent dog in a world that had not yet found any use for such a thing? She loved the Montell children. She wanted them to have normal lives, each with opportunities to be the center of attention. Some other members of the Mysterium had shaped their lives as Bella had shaped hers. Sometimes there was sadness in not openly being all that you should be, the person that you really were. But again, there was happiness on top of the sadness. Maintaining her secret had certain advantages, not least of all that she knew more about each child than Andrea and Bill knew, more than she would know if the kids realized how smart she really was. When they were at risk of going astray, she had the canine wiles with which to subtly steer them back on course. When that didn't work, she'd become clever at bringing the problem to the attention of Andrea and Bill without them always realizing who was the agent of revelation. In addition to being one of five Montell siblings, and their clandestine nanny as well, Bella was the editor of The Wire. The Wire could be turned on and off like a radio. Not all members of the Mysterium were listening at all times. However, it was possible to send an insistent message that would open even closed neural pathways and ensure that everyone received it. Bella's job was to gather important news and share it in a timely manner. She had volunteered to remain open for transmissions during daylight hours. She didn't have to worry about spreading rumors and untruths. No member of the Mysterium had ever known a dog to lie. On this Wednesday evening, as the Montell family sat for dinner in the dining room, Bella curled on a bed in the corner, pretending to sleep, when in fact she had big news to impart to her kind. Bellagram. As reported 2 weeks ago, Rusty and Mandy, members of the Donald and Georgina Curtis family of Corte Madera, were pleased to announce 5 pups, by far the largest known Mysterium litter at that time. All remain healthy. Now all 5 are transmitting telepathically at a limited distance and are able to quick learn language by the wire. They should be able to transmit at a distance soon. Donald and Georgina Curtis are fully aware of Rusty's and Mandy's nature and are prepared to keep all 5 pups. Much joy in Corte Madera. Something exciting is happening out there. Just today, Caesar and Cleo, members of the Robert and Maymay Ishigawa family of San Jose, produced a litter of 6, all healthy. Robert and Maymay are likewise aware of the Mysterium, and the offspring will remain in the family. We have long wondered where we came from, why we are here, and why there are so few of us. If suddenly our numbers are increasing, perhaps answers to our first 2 questions, the reason for our existence, will soon be revealed to us. Rejoice. Be true. Stay tuned. The Uninvited Guest. Wednesday, 5 p.m. to Thursday, 1 a.m. Chapter 28. Ben Hawkins stopped at a Tahoe City market to buy a case of canned gourmet dog food, not unlike what Dorothy had served, as well as deli sandwiches for his own dinner. Kip waited in the Range Rover. He didn't mind. He wasn't lonely. A colorful variety of people came and went from the market. Especially when unaware that they were being watched, human beings were always interesting. When Ben returned, he said, "I knew you wouldn't steal the Rover and leave me stranded. Maybe a poodle, but not you." They traveled a few miles farther to Olympic Valley, which was 25 miles or so from Dorothy's house above the lake. They were still moving toward the boy who murmured all but constantly on the wire. Before morning, Kip hoped to determine if Ben expected to continue in that direction. Olympic Valley offered 4-star accommodations at Squaw Valley Lodge and at the resort at Squaw Creek. However, Anti-dog bigotry required Kip and Ben to take a room at a 2-star operation. Enlightenment was ever ongoing. The mom-and-pop owners had a dog of their own. It was a Welsh corgi named Llewellyn. He came out through the gate in the check-in counter to greet Kip. He had stubby legs and a beautiful coat. Llewellyn smelled of oatmeal-based shampoo. On his breath were cooked carrots, green beans, and poached chicken, which he evidently had been given for dinner. If Llewellyn's weight and height were a disadvantage in any contest with a larger dog, they were ideal when it came to being in the best position to sniff Kip's crotch and butt. Llewellyn seemed surprised when Kip failed to return this traditional greeting. He was a friendly fellow, however, and he took no offense. His short tail was always wagging. The motel room proved to be simple and clean. Next to a small coffee brewer were complimentary packets of coffee, creamer, and sugar. Ben put his sandwiches and 2 cans of beer in the under-the-counter refrigerator. Like ghosts, the smells of people who had stayed here in the past haunted Kip's nose. The ugliest thing he found was a little dead pill bug in one corner of the bedroom, which wasn't terribly offensive. Unexpectedly, Kip was given an informal grooming. Ben produced a box of moist pet wipes in foil packets. He also had 2 different grooming combs. He hadn't bought those items at the market. For some reason, he'd already had them in the Range Rover.
"This will do till we can find a place to get you a real bath."
Living with Dorothy, Kip had been bathed every Thursday and regularly trimmed. Everyone said he looked like a show dog. During the long day of overland travel, which had brought him to the campground, he'd gotten a bit dirty and bedraggled. Ben didn't take off Kip's collar, but otherwise gave him a thorough wipe down. Of course, he had to endure a brief session with a hairdryer. Every life had its ups and downs. Once Kip was dry, Ben produced a water bowl and a food bowl. Both were white ceramic and made for dogs. The green-lettered name on each was Clover. These 2 had come from the Range Rover, not from the market in Tahoe City. Ben filled one bowl with water and emptied an entire can of the gourmet food into the other. Although he'd had the burger and frankfurter earlier, Kip ate this offering with pleasure, though not with canine haste. One of the first things that Dorothy had found peculiar about him, as a puppy, was that he savored his food rather than gobbling it in typical doggy fashion. With his sandwiches, beer, and a book, Ben settled in a chair at a small table by the window. After he had licked the bowl clean, Kip considered the mystery of it. He was exhausted after a busy day without naps, but curiosity wouldn't let him sleep. With one paw, he tipped the empty bowl on its side. With his nose, he rolled it across the carpet to Ben Hawkins. The writer looked up from his book and watched this performance without comment. Kip stopped the bowl next to Ben's chair, with the name Clover clearly visible. He sat and cocked his head in regard to the man.
"You want more food?"
Kip thumped his tail once, which meant no. But that was code he developed with Dorothy. This man couldn't know what it meant. Kip shook his head from side to side. Ben inserted a bookmark in the novel and set it aside. His expression was unreadable. As a former Navy SEAL, he was a man of reason who was cautious about making assumptions. After a silence, Ben said, "Did you just shake your head no?" Without hesitation, Kip moved his head up and down. They stared at each other. Kip had learned that a direct stare could convey considerable information, depending on the intensity and duration of it. Now he lowered his eyes to the name Clover on the dish, then looked again at Ben Hawkins. The writer picked up his can of beer, hesitated, and put it down without taking a drink.
"You know, you're a little spooky."
Patiently, Kip watched him, waited.
"Clover was my dog for 8 years. A rescue. I got her a few weeks after I was out of the Navy, the day before they would have put her down. She was a golden like you."
Kip issued a whimper of sympathy.
"Clover was a fine girl, fearless, but with the sweetest heart. Cancer was eating her alive. 5 months ago, I held her in my arms while the vet put her to sleep. It was the hardest damn thing I've ever done. Me, a big, tough Navy SEAL. The hardest thing."
Kip thought of Dorothy. He was very tired. He had never been so tired before. He padded to the farther end of the room and stared at the writer across the bed.
"You want to sleep up there?" "It's all right with me."
Marshalling what energy he had left, Kip sprang onto the mattress. He circled and laid down and closed his eyes. He heard the writer getting up from the chair, moving around. The seal on the refrigerator made a soft sucking sound as the door opened. The click-tear of the pull tab on a can. The smell of fresh cold beer. A moment later, the chair creaked as the writer settled in it once more.
"Spooky," Ben said again.
Dorothy smiled at Kip in the dream, and put a hand on his head and smoothed his fur and said,
"My special boy."
Chapter 29. Megan found Woody lying on his bed, atop the spread, fully clothed, in the fetal position, eyes open, which meant that he was distressed about something. He remained as silent as the versions of himself that appeared in some of her paintings, including the one of him in the moonlight with deer, which was currently on her easel. When she spoke to him, and he wouldn't even look at her, she could do nothing for him other than climb on the bed, spoon against his back, and put her arms around him. He had no objection to being held, though he never returned a hug. She didn't pressure him about what was wrong, because nothing could be gained either by insistence or gentle probing. When he was in this mood, he turned further inward on himself, and he would come out of it only when whatever issue caused it, some fear or sadness or confusion, had resolved itself. At times like these, she didn't know if holding him made any difference in his emotional state. She'd never seen evidence that it did. Holding him, however, made a difference for her, made her feel that she was doing something essential. When you loved someone as much as she loved Woody, and when you were helpless to console him when he seemed to need consolation the most, you could at times feel miserably inadequate. She had known that feeling. Now she counseled herself to remember that Woody always came out of these funks sooner than later. He didn't lie stricken like this for days, or even for longer than an hour or two. Whatever might cause these withdrawals, he was resilient enough to overcome it. And when he did return from emotional isolation to mere detachment, he would find her, and in that shy way of his, touch her and smile, to let her know that whatever had devastated him had now relented. As she held him and smoothed his thick black hair with one hand, she sang to him, softly, softly, one of those songs that he would sometimes play over and over for hours on his iPod while he read or used his computer. "When you're weary, feeling small." She heard Verna Brickett's car leaving the driveway and turning onto the state route. The housekeeper had a key. She would have locked the back door. She was reliable. "When tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all." Chapter 30. Lee Shackett stands at the window at the end of the side hall, watching as the older woman in the Toyota follows the driveway to the two-lane blacktop, turns south toward Pine Haven, and quickly cruises out of sight. Ravens appear again in the sky, as they had just before he shot to death the owner of the Shelby Supersnake. They wheel through the air less like ravens than like seagulls. For such usually solemn birds, they appear to be celebrating. Previously, there were three ravens. This time, seven engage in this aerial ballet. Throughout history and across all cultures, the numbers three and seven have had supernatural meaning. The ravens are for him, to encourage him in his becoming. He jams the pistol under his belt and takes from a pocket of his jeans the feather that had fallen to his hand as he'd pursued Justine. The soft barbs sprouting from the shaft to form the vein are glossy black, inky, yet with a hint of midnight blue, as if the bird that shed it was an emissary of some ancient god of darkness, and in the name of its master had stolen the color of the daytime sky to ensure eternal night. After returning the feather to his pocket, he draws the pistol. He steps to the door on the right and eases it open, and enters a room where the only illumination issues through tall windows in the north wall. Because the overcast is thicker, because the false twilight is becoming the real thing, and perhaps because rain is impending, the quality of light suggests an underwater realm, as though he is not in a house, but rather in a submerged vessel. And yet he has no need to turn on a lamp. When he moves from the brighter hallway into this room, his eyes adjust as they never would have before,
His vision has been improving. Now his eyes take what light is available and somehow multiply it so that he sees at once that he is in Megan's studio. A large canvas appears near completion, and he is drawn to it. This is yet another of her works that, in spite of the photorealism with which it's rendered, is incomprehensible to Lee Shackett. What is it supposed to mean? What feelings is it intended to evoke? In the foreground stand three deer and a boy. The boy is Woody. He's feeding slices of an apple to the deer. The pale moonlight is eerily diffuse, strangely reflected, in counterpoint to the realism of all else. For reasons that he can't explain, he is profoundly irritated by this image. He wants to go to the kitchen and find a sharp knife and slash the canvas to ribbons. Not yet. In time, he will destroy every one of her paintings in this house. Once she is submitted to him, once she has been reduced to the essence of what she is and understands her place, Megan will destroy them herself at his direction. The only meaning, the only truth he can see in this painting is that the deer and the mentally deficient boy are weak, nothing but prey that are destined to be taken by a predator. Chapter 31. After she sang to Woody and thought she felt him relax slightly in her arms, Megan said, "Meatloaf, potato and cheese casserole, one of your favorite dinners, and for dessert, Verna's best muffins with ice cream. I'll be in the kitchen whenever you're ready. Take your time, honey." She got off the bed and stood over him and smiled and bent down and kissed his cheek. The boy still stared at nothing, as though in a state of shock, but she was pretty sure that he was coming around. His computer and desk lamp were off. A thick sheaf of papers, held together by a spring clip, lay to the right of the keyboard. Megan wondered what he had printed, but she didn't take a look at it. Every child needed privacy and trust, but that was especially true of Woody, who had an extreme aversion to his personal space being invaded. For all of his limitations, he was a good kid, and whatever he'd been doing, he would sooner or later share it with her. After switching on one of the nightstand lamps, she left the room, quietly closing the door behind her. She went down the narrow back stairs, which terminated in the kitchen. The meatloaf stood on a wire rack in a pan beside the ovens. When it cooled and firmed, she'd cut two servings to be reheated. Covered with foil, the finished potato and cheese casserole waited in the warming drawer. The back door proved to be locked, as she'd known it would be. Verna Brickett was an entertaining curmudgeon, but she was also as reliable as the rising and setting of the sun. Megan put plastic placemats and paper napkins and flatware on the breakfast table. For whatever reason, Woody ate with less haste and was more content at dinner if the meal was served by candlelight. Megan put six small red votive glasses on the table and inserted a 4-hour candle in each. The candle glow must always be filtered through red glass. If the holders were clear, the flickering flames agitated Woody. If the glass was blue, he lost his appetite. If it was green, he grew depressed. She didn't put china on the table, but set it on a counter for later service. She required one plate, but Woody needed a plate for his meatloaf and three shallow dishes, one each for servings of the potato cheese casserole and the two accompanying vegetables. If one food touched another, he could not eat it. She didn't know why, and perhaps neither did he. When Woody came down from his room, she would put the carrots and the cauliflower on the stove to cook and pour his cocktail. If Megan was drinking a white wine, Woody wanted a clear, flavored water. As she was drinking red, he wanted grape raspberry to match the color of her Cabernet. Trapped as he was within his condition, he nevertheless sought connections between them, however awkwardly. She allowed herself one or two glasses of wine in the evening. Now, as she waited for Woody, she poured Camus Cabernet. At the window in the back door, she stared at the yard where, in her current canvas, Woody stood feeding the deer. Only a few of her works featured the boy, but once she painted him in a setting, the place never seemed right again without him in it. In spite of his autism, or perhaps because of it, he possessed a gravity that she couldn't explain, that bent the world around him, reshaped any venue, and colored it anew and gave it fresh meaning. The yard now, without him, looked incomplete, like a simple sketch, a study for a more serious scene.
She supposed that it wasn't Woody who transformed those places where she'd painted him, but rather her love for him that made her see a mystical quality in them. At the end of the lawn, in the gathering dusk, the forest darkled into a castellated architecture of turrets and battlements, just as she portrayed it in the current painting. She hadn't quite known why she'd given it an ominous character, but now she realized that it represented the evils of the world that contrasted so starkly with Woody's innocence, which would be such a threat to him if anything happened to her and she was no longer here to protect him. She went to the table, where earlier she'd left a half-read novel. She sat and found her page and began to read again. The day had been one of accomplishment, and her pleasure felt earned. The story was good, and the wine was better. A theme of the novel seemed to be the power of solitude. She assured herself that she wasn't lonely, and she knew that assurance for a lie. She told herself that life was good, that there were worse things than loneliness, and those were truths. Chapter 32. The hallway light passes through the living room archway and lays a faint golden arc across floor and furniture, but the deeper reaches of the large room are veiled with shadows as the day recedes beyond the French windows. Shackett's strange augmented eyes conjure an eerie light by which he crosses the room to the Steinway. He had forgotten that Megan played the piano. The lid is down on this parlor grand, and upon it stands an artfully arranged collection of photographs, the silver frames of which attract what light reaches this part of the room. His new way of seeing makes the silver seem to be in motion, molten and flowing, even though the frames retain their shapes. The photographs are from happier days when the family remained intact. Jason and Megan, Jason and Woody, Megan and Woody, three of them together, Jason by himself, and another of Jason, and another, Mom and Dad always smiling, but the kid only sometimes. The brain-screwed kid. The mental case. Jason steals Megan from Shackett, and he saddles her with the useless boy. And then he dies, and still the treacherous son of a bitch is here. Still in possession of her heart. One by one, Shackett turns the photos face down. Later, when the boy is dead, when Megan understands who owns her now, he will watch while she takes the photos from the frames and throws them in the fireplace and burns them. Noises arise from the back of the house, probably from the kitchen. He's not concerned. The sounds remain at a distance. He can smell her back there. The moistness of her. Such a hot bitch. And she isn't approaching. This is his house now. She doesn't know it, but this house belongs to Shackett. He can burn it down if he wants. If after the boy is dead, if after Shackett has slipped into Megan's bed in the night and shown her what she's been missing all these years, if still the slut refuses to submit, he will do to her what he did to Justine. Then I'll set the house on fire and leave for Costa Rica. For there are a lot of hot women. The jungle and the sea, and more hot women than he will ever need. In his becoming, he amazes himself, for he has not previously been so decisive in all matters. He leaves the living room and steps into the hallway and goes to the front stairs. As he ascends, he runs his tongue back and forth over his teeth, back and forth, across the lowers and uppers, not over the molars and the bicuspids, but over the canines and the incisors. The canines and the incisors. Chapter 33. Embarrassed, worse than embarrassed, mortified and ashamed that he had nearly revealed himself to the murderers behind the dark website called Tragedy, that he had come close to endangering himself and his mother, Woody Bookman retreated to Castle Wyvern, where he often found solace in solitude and sought to regain confidence in his worst hours. Castle Wyvern was a structure of his imagination, but in times like these, it seemed more solid and convincing in its details than the so-called real world. The outer curtain wall was 14 feet wide. Parallel 2-foot-thick courses of native sandstone, the 10 feet between them filled with a rubble of loose rocks and mortar. 10 formidable towers soared into a perpetually stormy sky, including 2 each at the outer gatehouse and the postern gatehouse. The outer ward was separated from the inner ward by a second and more massive curtain wall with an even more impregnable gatehouse and six larger towers. The wall walks featured merlins with narrow arrow loops and embrasures from which boiling oil and buckets of stones could be poured down on enemies attacking from below. Each gatehouse had to be approached on a 25-foot-high ramp guarded by archers. Each ramp ended at a drawbridge spanning a moat. Every gatehouse featured a heavy timber portcullis plated with iron, which could be lowered to deny entrance, and beyond each portcullis stood a pair of iron-bound wooden doors that could be closed in an emergency and reinforced by double drawbars. The name of the castle had been chosen with care. A wyvern was a particularly ferocious two-legged dragon with a wicked barbed tail. Bad people were likely to be reluctant to try to force their way into a place named Castle Wyvern, Castle Dragon. In times of deepest mortification and shame, Woody took refuge in his high redoubt, a round chamber at the top of the southwest tower of the inner curtain wall, a timbered ceiling, narrow windows looking to the four points of the compass, stone walls, stone floor. He had only a pile of reeds to lie on, because there should be no comforts to reward a boy who had brought shame on himself by his foolishness and stupidity. When he had paid a sufficient price for his errors, he would receive a sign permitting him to leave the castle and return to Pinehaven in the so-called real world, which was how things worked in stories about castles and high redoubts and lands where dragons roamed. Although the windows of the buildings of the inner ward had glass in their frames, there was none up here in this tower. In bad weather, cold wind blew in, and rain slanted through the empty panes to shatter on the stone, depending on what punishment his actions required. And when his sentence had been served, he received a sign in the form of a bluebird or a soft-furred white rat that came in through a glassless window. The former sang his reprieve, or the latter danced amusingly to indicate that he was free. Now, as he curled upon his bed of reeds, he heard the door of the high redoubt open behind him. If the door opened before he had seen the bluebird or the white rat, the visitor would be his mother who had come to the castle to check on him. He couldn't leave until he'd done his time, not even if he would please his mother if he rose from the bed and went to her. If he left before he received a sign, the shame that he'd earned would still cling to him, and his mother would see the truth of her son, and she would then share his humiliation that she had given birth to such a child. She had been here earlier too, had held him and sung to him. He was surprised that she would return so soon. She always allowed him privacy. Mother didn't know about Castle Wyvern, but the door to Woody's high redoubt and the door to his real-world bedroom were, for her, magically connected. She saw the physical Woody on his bed, while the spirit of Woody lay abashed in the castle tower. That was how things worked in the fantasy land to which he could escape from the hard world in which he'd been born, and in which she so often screwed up. Behind him, his mother stood in the open door for the longest time. Because it could be no one but her, he thought she intended to come to him again and smooth his hair, and sing to him in her pretty voice. When he was withdrawn into the castle's high redoubt, she had never before visited him more than once. She knew that he could only return according to his own schedule, and that by appealing to him, she was only ensuring that he would remain in retreat longer. Finally, she closed the door and went away. Woody curled tighter on his bed of reeds, drawing his knees toward his chest. Chapter 34. The useless boy lies with his back to the door, motionless on his bed, with no deer in attendance, bathed not in moonlight, but in the glow of a nightstand lamp, as the day dies beyond the windows. The child is easy prey, but the time isn't right. Shacket trembles with the desire to bite. But the time isn't right. He wants Megan first. Wants to slide deep into her, and by taking her, at last pay back Jason Bookman, who had stolen her from him, stolen her, and then set Shacket up to take the fall for Dorian Purcell. Megan must be his, as she was always meant to be. And with her he can then father a superior child, which Jason's damaged seed could not produce. If she submits and recognizes his extraordinary power, realizes what he's becoming,
and understands that without him there is no future for her. Then they will ravage the boy together. But if she resists, he'll paralyze her, and as she lies in helpless witness, he'll bite the life out of the little freak and then set the house afire. His newfound decisiveness thrills him. He no longer must ask for anyone's advice, or waste time in consultation, or seek approval. No one is the boss of him. Neither the law nor any code of morality constrains him, because he knows them to be fantasies of order. In truth, the only rule by which anyone can live successfully, either in the wilds or in civilization, is the sole mandate of cruel nature. Prey shall submit, and predators shall reign supreme. Farther along in the hallway he finds the master bedroom, ashen light at the windows, glowing green numbers on the bedside clock radio. This meager illumination is barely adequate even for his dark-adapted and still-adapting eyes, but he makes his way to the king-size bed without turning on a lamp. He can see just well enough to realize that the spread has been removed and folded on the padded bench at the foot of the bed. The bedclothes have been turned back for the night, most likely by the housekeeper who departed in the Toyota. Shackett drops to his knees to smell the fitted sheet and the top sheet between which Megan's lithesome body has lain. The linens have not been changed today, sparing him the disappointment of nothing more than a residue of laundry detergent and fabric softener. By smell, he can distinguish between the shampooed freshness of her raven hair and the slightly salty creaminess of her lustrous skin, and the moistness of the cleft between her legs, where later he will make their future. He puts his pistol on the nightstand and sits on the edge of the big bed. He unties his shoes and slips out of them, but does not undress before lying where she spent the previous night, first on his back, with the top sheet and thin blanket drawn to his chin. The high thread count cotton that has clung to her long legs and snucked her mons veneris and draped her breasts now wraps him, and he feels cocooned in the essence of her. Chapter 35. In the house above Lake Tahoe, Rosa Leon had phoned Roger Austin, Dorothy's attorney, using his cell number now that office hours had passed. She hadn't called him to confirm that she was the sole heir. There was no reason for Dorothy to have deceived her with a false promise. But Mr. Austin was supposed to come to the house the day after the death, and that appointment needed to be changed. Roger Austin had the deep yet mellifluous voice of a gifted speaker who could charm audiences, and everyone said that, as a man, his character was the equal of his fine voice. He was principled and trustworthy, and a reliable rock in all circumstances. When he spoke of Dorothy Hummel's passing, this rock's voice fractured a few times, and once he had to stop for a minute to gather himself, which made Rosa regard him even more highly. He knew that she'd seen the video, but nevertheless he told her all that the estate contained after taxes. He wanted to share her wonder in the change that had been wrought so suddenly in her life, and she had no difficulty giving him a taste of it. He wished also to assure her that, in association with him, Dorothy's accountant would provide her with guidance in the days to come. "But can we delay tomorrow's meeting until perhaps Friday?" she asked. "I've some important things to attend to, and I can't delay dealing with them."
"Certainly, Rosa. How about 3 o'clock Friday afternoon?"
"That should be fine," she said. "And thank you, Mr. Austin, for having been such a good friend to Dorothy."
"Please call me Roger, as she did. Being a friend to Dorothy was the easiest thing in the world."
He laughed softly, perhaps to keep his voice from faltering again.
"She was one of a very small number of people in this world whom I've loved as much as myself."
When the call concluded, Rosa was eager to get on the road in pursuit of Kip. If he had fled in grief, she would share it with him, and by sharing, relieve the poor creature of some of that terrible weight. However, she worried that he hadn't fled at all, but had been snatched instead, as melodramatic as that sounded. Dog-napping was, in fact, the first thing that Dorothy had most feared. At the moment, Kip was in the vicinity of Olympic Valley, approximately 28 miles from here, and it seemed to Rosa that he couldn't have traveled that far afoot in the time that he'd been gone. His special collar issued a unique signal tracked by a state-of-the-art service, Pied Finder. The company supplied wristwatches and other items for children in which a transponder was embedded.
making it possible to follow them by GPS if they should be taken by a kidnapper, by some Pied Piper, or be lost. They supplied, as well, collars for dogs. The Pied Finder app allowed Rosa to track Kip on Dorothy's smartphone. Her greatest fear at the moment was that the little lithium battery powering the transponder might go dead before she recovered the dog. It needed to be changed twice a month, and she didn't know when Dorothy had last inserted a new one in the collar. She had not mentioned this crisis to Roger Austin because he knew nothing of Kip's secret. There was no one but Rosa to go to the dog's aid. Guilt and worry weighed heavily on her. She should not have left Kip alone during the cremation and later. She hadn't at that time known his magical nature, but she'd been acutely aware of how important he was to Dorothy. Rosa owed her good fortune to the golden retriever. Although Dorothy was fond of Rosa, she would not have left the entire estate to her caregiver if Kip hadn't existed. A generous measure might have been bequeathed to Rosa, but the larger portion would have gone to charities that Dorothy had long supported. Now Rosa Leon set the alarm and locked the house and departed in Dorothy's Lincoln MKX. She steered the vehicle slowly through a forbidding fog, like one of those in which sailors on a blinded sea sometimes glimpsed ancient ghost ships with torn sails, or legendary monsters of the deep that breached, glaring with glowing eyes, only to dive beneath the waves, never to be seen again. With visibility reduced to 20 feet, she took almost 15 minutes to follow surface streets to State Route 89, which was no more than a 4 or 5 minute drive on a clear evening. She went north on Highway 89, hoping that the fog would lift, or at least thin out. If it remained as it was, the 40-minute trip to Olympic Valley might take 2 hours or longer, but the constant risk that some damn fool, trusting to wits he didn't possess, would crash into her at the posted speed limit. Blinking red signifier on the navigation map, presented on the smartphone screen, indicated that Kip hadn't moved since she'd located him. Wherever he might be, with whomever, he apparently had settled down, at least for the night. Like the probing beams of a bathysphere exploring a murky oceanic trench, headlights of an oncoming vehicle appeared at first hazy and dim, but swelled in brightness. Southbound on the undivided highway, the vehicle itself was invisible until it swept past, a crew cab pickup, as white as the fog from which it manifested. The driver carved through the night at perhaps half the speed limit, but that was still too fast in these conditions. In his wake, Rosa slowed further. The primary pattern of this momentous day unnerved her. She had lost her dearest friend, her only friend. She had inherited a fortune. She had sat through a long and dispiriting cremation. She had learned a miraculous and uplifting secret about Kip. The dog had gone missing, and then she seemed to have located him by extraordinary means. A loss, followed by a blessing, followed by a loss, followed by a blessing. A hard life had prepared her to expect that nothing good could last. Chapter 36. Everyone who was murdered in Pinehaven County, or died by accident, received the personal attention of Carson Conroy, who had come here to escape the senseless violence of the city. But first, having been discovered by a deputy sheriff on regular patrol, the bodies of Payton Spader and Justine Kleinman were extensively photographed in situ and removed in such a manner as to disturb the scene as little as possible. Rural law enforcement did not always show such respect for potential evidence. Because the deep overcast throttled the afternoon light, and because there was a 60% chance of rain that, if it came, might erase evidence, a generator and Klieg lights were brought to the scene in an expeditious manner and judiciously positioned an hour and a half before nightfall. Under the direction of a deputy with special training in the discovery and handling of forensic evidence, a crew of the sheriff's men searched the graveled shoulder of the highway, the slope beyond, and the swale at the foot of the slope in which the victims had been found. The perpetrator had not returned directly to his vehicle after killing the woman, but had angled through the meadow to a stream, trampling the tall grass and leaving drops of blood on some of those flattened green blades. They found his discarded blood-stained shirt, plus a shoulder holster without a firearm. The bodies were taken to the county morgue. A tow truck operator who had a contact with the county loaded the Shelby Super Snake onto a flatbed, and always in the company of a supervising deputy who could testify that the chain of evidence had not been broken, conveyed the vehicle to an impound garage in the same complex as the Sheriff's Department HQ and the morgue. The bloody shirt and the shoulder rig were brought to Carson Conroy in a brown paper shopping bag. At 42, after he'd risen through the ranks of the medical examiner's office in Chicago, murder capital of the nation, Carson had become dispirited because homicide so often went unsolved. Most of the murders were gang-related, and the city's governing elite had proved unable or unwilling to deal with the gangs. The violence became as personal as it could get when his wife, Lissa, was killed in a drive-by shooting that had all the signs of a gangbanger initiation. Some wannabe thug offing a civilian to prove that his balls were big and his heart was too small ever to trouble him with doubt. That was the hardest kind of case to solve, because no rational motive existed, no provable cause and effect. Carson knew Lissa's killer would never be found, and he couldn't live in a city where the trigger man who took her life still enjoyed a life of his own. That was 5 years earlier, and still her murder had not been solved.